It was only with the slaughter of the NKVD and military brass between March and July 1937 that Stalin emerged as the absolute dictator. Even then, he still had to convince his magnates to do his bidding. How did he do it? There was the character of Stalin himself. The cult of personality was so pervasive in the country that, as Khrushchev said, Stalin's word was law. He could do no wrong. Stalin could see it all clearly. But the terror was not merely Stalin's will. He may have inspired much of it, and it may have reflected his own hatreds and complexes, but his magnates were constantly urging him to purge more enemies. Nonetheless, when they knew the victim, they required proof. That was the reason Stalin paid such attention to the written words of confessions, signed by the victims, often confessing to unlikely crimes. As soon as he received testimonies from Yezhov, Stalin distributed them to the Politburo, who found this deluge of self-incrimination and denunciation hard to refute. There was a peculiarly religious aspect. Vyshinsky, briefed by Stalin, addressed the accused at the January 1937 trial thus: "You lost faith." As Stalin told Beria, "An enemy of the people is not only one who does sabotage, but one who doubts the rightness of the party line, and there are a lot of them, and we must liquidate them." In the mornings, Blackberry visited the Politburo and attended meetings, coming straight from the torture chambers. One day, Khrushchev noticed spots of clotted blood on the hem and cuffs of Yezhov's peasant blouse. Khrushchev, himself no angel, asked Yezhov what the spots were. Yezhov replied, with a flash of his blue eyes, that one should take pride in such specks because they were the blood of the enemies of the revolution. Stalin often wrote instructions beside prisoners' names, adding "beat, beat" to one name and "where is he, in a prison or a hotel" to another. In 1937, the Politburo specified officially that torture should be used. As Stalin later asserted, the NKVD practice of the use of physical pressure permitted by the Central Committee was a totally correct and expedient method. Yezhov supervised his torturers, who had their own jargon for their work. They called the process of destroying an innocent human "French wrestling." When some of them were interrogated themselves years later, they revealed how they used the Zhiguti, the special club, and the Dubinka, the truncheon, as well as the more traditional prevention of sleep and constant interrogation that they called the conveyor belt. The CK had long had a cult of torture. Indeed, one of Yagoda's men had written a manual. Frequently, Politburo members such as Molotov and Mikoyan would go over to interrogate their comrades in Yezhov's grand office at the Lubyanka. Kaganovich thought it was very difficult not to be cruel, but one must take into consideration that they were experienced old Bolsheviks. How could they give testimonies voluntarily? Many of the prisoners were beaten so hard that their eyes literally popped out of their heads. They were routinely beaten to death, which was registered as a heart attack. Yezhov himself devised the system of execution. Instead of using the cellars of the Lubyanka or the other prisons as his predecessors had done, he created a special abattoir. A low, squarish building was specially constructed, with a concrete floor sloping towards a far wall built of logs, to absorb the bullets, and hosing facilities to wash away the fluids. After a shot to the back of the head, the victims were placed in metal boxes and driven to one of the crematoria in Moscow. The ashes were usually dumped into a mass grave, such as the one at the Donskoy Cemetery. The road that ended in the Donskoy often began in a note on Stalin's desk. Stalin received not only pleas for life, but denunciations demanding death. Once the terror was unleashed, denunciations worked like kerosene on a fire. They were already a vital part of the Stalinist system. Everyone was expected to denounce everyone else. Denunciations poured into Stalin's office. Usually, these poisonous letters were the result of witch-hunting mania, cannibalistic malice, and amoral ambition. Stalin relished the decision on how to treat the denunciations. If he did not like the person, the letters went to the NKVD with a note, "Check," and death probably followed. If he wished to preserve the person, he would file it, and he might reactivate it years later. Hence his papers overflow with denunciations, some from ordinary people, others from top officials. A typical denunciation, which Stalin read and marked, came from a certain Krylov in distant Saratov, who told his leader that enemies have friends inside the NKVD and the procuracy and are hiding enemies. The military were as avid as anyone else. "I ask you to dismiss Commander Osipov," wrote an officer from Tiflis, "who is a very suspicious person." Stalin underlined "suspicious" with his blue pen. Another tool was Polya Nikolaenka, the heroic denunciatrix of Kiev, championed by Stalin. The speciality of this terrifying crone, responsible for the deaths of as many as 8,000 people, was to stand up at meetings and shriek accusations. Khrushchev saw how she pointed her finger and said, "I don't know that man over there, but I can tell by the look in his eyes that he's an enemy of the people." This talk of the look in the eyes was another sign of the terror's religious frenzy. The regions were soon killing too many too quickly. Khrushchev effectively ordered the shooting of 55,741 officials, which more than fulfilled the original Politburo quota of 50,000. On the 10th of July 1937, Khrushchev wrote to Stalin to request shooting 2,000 ex-kulaks to fulfill the quota. The NKVD archives show him initialing many documents proposing arrests. By spring 1938, he had overseen the arrest of 35 of the 38 provincial and city secretaries, which gives some idea of this fever. Since he was based in Moscow, he brought death lists directly to Stalin and Molotov. "There can't be so many," exclaimed Stalin. "There are, in fact, more," replied Khrushchev, according to Molotov. "You can't imagine how many there are." The city of Stalinabad was given a quota of 6,277 to shoot, but actually executed 13,259. But mostly, they were killing the wrong people. The regional bosses selected the victims, finding it irresistible to destroy their opponents and preserve their friends. Yet it was precisely these princes with their entourages that Stalin wished to destroy. Thus the first secretary's initial bloodletting not only did not save them, it provided an excuse for their own eradication. It was only a matter of time before the center unleashed a second wave of terror to eradicate the princes themselves. All the magnates set off on bloody tours of the country. Zhdanov purged the Urals and Middle Volga. Ukraine was unfortunate enough to welcome Kaganovich, Molotov and Yezhov. Kaganovich then visited Kazakhstan, Chelyabinsk, Ivanovo, and other places spreading terror. But nothing compared to the killing frenzy of the two most prolific monsters on tour, Andrei Andreev and Georgi Malenkov. Andreev set out to ravage the Volga German Republic. "All means are necessary to purge Saratov," he told Stalin in the first of a stream of excited, fanatical telegrams. By the next day, Andreev was frantically arresting suspects. "We had to arrest the second secretary. On Flesher, we have evidence he was member of rightist Trotskyite organization. We ask permission to arrest." One group consisted of 20 very obstructively working in the machine tractor station. We decided to arrest and prosecute two of the directors, who turned out to be part of a right kulak organization that had wrecked tractors. Or rather, they had worked slowly since only 14 out of 74 were ready. Stalin replied in his blue pencil, "Central Committee agrees with your proposals about prosecution and shooting of former MTS workers." 20 were shot. 3 days later, Andreev boasted to Stalin that he had found a fascist organization. "We plan to arrest at once the first group of 50 to 60 people. We had to arrest the Premier of the Republic, Luf, for proven membership of right Trotskyites." Andreev proceeded to the town of Kuibyshev, and then to Central Asia, where he removed all the leaderships since Stalin had told him, "Generally, you can act as you consider." The result was that in Stalinabad, "I have arrested 7 narcoms, 55 CC chiefs, 3 CC secretaries," and returning to Voronezh, he declared cheerfully, "There is no bureau here. All arrested as enemies. Off to Rostov now." Andreev was accompanied on these manic trips by Georgi Malenkov, a plump young man of 35. He was the maestro of the terror, a killer bureaucrat whose career benefited the most from the purges. One historian estimates that Malenkov was responsible for 150,000 deaths. Small, flabby, pale and moon-faced, with a hairless chin, freckles across his nose and dark, slightly Mongol eyes, his black hair hanging across his forehead, Malenkov had broad female hips, a pear shape, and a high voice. It's no wonder that Zhdanov nicknamed him Melania, or Melanie. Happily married, Malenkov was known as a wonderful father to his highly educated children, teaching them himself, and reading them poetry, even when he was exhausted at the height of the war. His wife helped get him a job in the Central Committee, where he was noticed by Molotov, joined Stalin's secretariat, and became secretary of the Politburo during the early 30s, one of those keen young men like Yezhov, who won first Kaganovich's, then Stalin's notice for their devotion and efficiency. This cunning but eunuch-like magnate never spoke unless necessary, and always listened to Stalin, scribbling in a notebook headed Comrade Stalin's Instructions. In October, another plenum approved the arrest of yet more members of the Central Committee. "It happened gradually," said Molotov. 70 expelled 10 people, then 60 expelled another 15. When a terrified local leader appealed to Stalin to receive me for just 10 minutes on personal matters, I'm accused in a terrible lie. Stalin scribbled in green pencil to Paskryobyshev, "Say I'm on holiday."